This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard said Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated in Tehran. That statement gave no details on how he was killed. Suspicion immediately fell on Israel, which has vowed to kill Hamas leaders over the group's October 7th attack on Israel. Israel itself did not immediately comment. There was no immediate reaction from the White House. Meanwhile, an Israeli strike on Tuesday on the densely populated southern suburbs of Beirut heightened fears of an escalation of wider conflict in the Middle East. Scores of supporters of the Venezuelan opposition gathered on the streets of Caracas on Tuesday after a disputed president election, with many chanting freedom. The opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, asked her supporters to remain peaceful, even if provoked by government allies. Protests in Venezuela spread on Tuesday as anger grew over the awarding of Sunday's election to President Nicolas Maduro, despite opposition claims that they had clinched a landslide victory. Far-right protesters, fueled by anger and false online rumors, hurled bottles and stones at police, wounding more than 20 police officers Tuesday outside Northwest England Mosque, near where three girls were fatally stabbed the day earlier. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, condemned the thuggery and said that the crowd had hijacked what had earlier been a peaceful vigil, attending by hundreds in the center of Southport to mourn the dead and 10 surviving stabbing victims, 7 of whom were in critical condition. This is VOA News. Hundreds of rescue workers are searching through debris from landslides that have killed at least 151 people in southern India. Torrential rains triggered torrents of mud and water that swept through tea estates and villages. The police officer, who uses one name, says that another 186 people were injured by landslides that hit hilly areas in Kerala State's district early Tuesday, flattening houses, uprooting trees, and destroying a bridge. The efforts of over 300 rescuers were hampered by blocked roads and unstable terrain. Acting Secret Service boss says that he cannot defend why a roof in the Trump rally shooting was unsecured.
Ronald Rowe says he went to the Pennsylvania site, climbed on the roof, and laid in the shooter's position.
What I saw made me ashamed.
As a former protective detail agent,
I cannot defend why that roof was not better secured.
Rowe told two Senate panels while his agency failed, he's also troubled local law enforcement never reported seeing a gunman on the roof before the shooting.
We didn't know that there was this incident going on.
The FBI is also sharing new details about the shooter, saying a social media account believed associated with him supported political violence and extreme views. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
An announcement of China's car giant BYD will build a billion-dollar factory in Turkey, marking a big turnaround in relations between the two countries. Details from VOA's Dorian Jones from Istanbul.
July saw China's BYD car giant sign an agreement to build a billion-dollar factory in Turkey. The factory will produce 150,000 vehicles annually, mainly for the European Union market. Analysts say the planned factory is a way to avoid the EU's new tariffs on Chinese vehicles. And they say the new investment is also a sign of a shift in Beijing's policy after years of avoiding investing in Turkey. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
After days of delays and uncertainty over water quality in the river, the women's and men's Olympic triathlon races will go forward Wednesday with a swim in the famed Paris Waterway. The decision to go ahead with the swim for the triathlon competition is a big win for the city. Olympics organizers and athletes, officials undertook an ambitious plan including 1.4 billion euros and infrastructure improvements to clean up the long polluted, and have been steadfast in their insistence that the swimming portion of the triathlon and marathon swimming events next week could be safe. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impogo in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Chinese road projects to link resource-rich regions of the Democratic Republic of Congo with its capital, Kinshasa.
The business people, they don't mind because they can buy at high price and then sell at high price. They will still maintain their margin. But for civil servants, for the military, for the police, for educational institutions, and then everyone and who is on a fixed income would probably carry the burden of this policy.
Ethiopians say the devaluation of the local currency could lead to severe inflation and soaring prices.
It was never clear before our study was published which of those five global change drivers most increased disease and which most decreased disease. And if there's particular global change drivers that are reducing the risk of infectious to humans, you obviously would want to put less time and effort into controlling those drivers of infectious diseases versus those that are increasing disease.
And a new study published in the journal Nature suggests that biodiversity loss may be a main driver of infectious diseases across the world. Those stories are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Three major road projects linking resource-rich regions of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, with its capital, Kinshasa, have begun as a part of a renegotiated Minerals for Infrastructure deal, according to local media. The deal comes months after Chinese companies agreed to increase infrastructure investments in DRC from $3 billion U.S. dollars to $7 billion, a statement from President Felix Tshisekedi's office after the groundbreaking ceremony said the Kinshasa Ring Road was made possible because of the renegotiated deal. Mulengwa Zihindura is the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He tells me that this project, if well implemented, would be great for the country.
I think this would be a very good thing for the country if this can be materialized. But we all know that we've been hearing about these Chinese contracts, about minerals for infrastructures for a very long time, and nothing has been materialized ever since. So it would be a good thing. I think people would be very happy if they can build infrastructures from the east into the western part of the country.
Many people have argued that lack of road infrastructure in DRC has been a major hindrance to development. But given that the various foreign interest in eastern DRC and the instability there, what chances are there that this project will proceed as planned?
Again, that's an obstacle, and I do not understand how one can build infrastructures that come from the east or the west to the west when a large part of the country right now is under the control of proxy forces that are allied to a foreign country. I don't know how this is going to be done unless, first and foremost, we can resolve this issue of the war of aggression.
Given China's track record in infrastructure development in Africa, do you think that this deal is in the best interest of the DRC people?
If this was genuine, yes. But I can tell you firsthand, I've seen a lot of the Chinese roads that were built in eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it was disastrous. The work they do is absolutely useless work. I have seen it firsthand myself, and these are roads they try to build and do not last long. So I don't really trust this to be effective. These are absolutely disastrous type of work that they've done in eastern DRC.
Is it better for bilaterals arrangements like this, or maybe DRC would have done better getting a loan to construct its own infrastructure?
I think what the DRC needs, they need proper contracts, proper people, well-trained to be able to build these roads. Whether they get a loan or whether they exchange some of the country resources with somebody, but let it be done properly with the appropriate people. But everything that the Chinese have built in the Congo, including my hometown of Bukavu, has been disastrous, absolutely disastrous, and these roads do not follow the proper structures the way these roads are supposed to be built. What I would like to add is that, I hope the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo can first try to resolve this issue of the war that is devastating the population. Otherwise, this is going to be very difficult. Any infrastructure project undertaken going from the east to the west is unattainable.
That's Mlengwa Zihindura, the president of the Center for Political and Strategic Studies in DRC and a former spokesperson for President Joseph Kabila. He spoke with me earlier from Kansas City. Residents in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa are concerned about the devaluation of the local currency, saying it may cause severe inflation and soaring prices. Shoppers told VOA on Tuesday that they are already encountering soaring prices. The Ethiopian government on Sunday announced a new foreign exchange directive which will allow its currency to float freely based on market forces. A day later, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, approved a $3.4 billion loan for Ethiopia. On the line to Addis Ababa, Asmama Ayenu spoke to Yared Halis Mekel, an economist based in Addis Ababa, and asked about the reaction to the government's measures.
The way I see it is, it's now probably the wrong time to do this kind of policy shift because the interest, we have the highest inflation rate in Ethiopia, and then the salary of the employees, the public service, the police, the army, and all that thing is still has been stagnant for last couple of years. So now the issue might create, necessary political instability to go, on a full scale liberalization of the financial sector. It may come with the political, tag of instability. That's the issue. But in policy, I've been an advocate of liberalization of the Ethiopian economy and then have published a lot on those issues. But the way we need to do is we have to be very careful, how to implement it. If you need, probably you want to discuss the detail, we can go on and then probably, I can explain why. And it, the way it is implemented is not giving inspiration for economic progress at the moment.
What are the impact of this policy shift could have on daily life and business of in Ethiopia?
The daily life is already hard. In the last couple of years, the inflation was about 37%, while the wage has been stagnant. There was no pay rise, there is no increase. So life is very expensive. And then the dollar came from 29 5 years ago to now it was 57 officially. But an official exchange rate was about 115, 120. So everything that's coming into Ethiopia was factored, five times more expensive than what it was, from 29, 30 to 120. So fuel has increased, fertilizer price has increased, cooking oil, salt, and everything. Ethiopia imports about $21 billion worth of goods, while Ethiopia exports about $4-5 billion worth of goods exports. So the gap is huge. It's about $14 billion. So, now the government, the World Bank might give to plug in some of the deficits at the moment. And then when they do that, they may have a temporary impact. But in the long run, it's not possible to gap the bridge at the moment. Because the moment when we have liberalized the financial sector, we were expecting to bring, foreign direct investment. At the moment, the Egyptian political situation is not conducive for investors. Tigray was a conflict area. Oromia has got a big political issue, still going, conflict going. The Amhara region is also under conflict. So, where it's kind of, beyond the World Bank subsidy of this $3.4 billion or of cash injection, where the money is going to come. So that will probably create a big impact on the lives of those people who are on a fixed income. I mean, the business people, they don't mind because they can buy at higher price and then sell at higher price. They will still maintain their margins. But for civil servants, for the military, for the police, for educational institution, the university professors, and then everyone and who is on a fixed income would probably carry the burden of this policy.
Yared Haile-Mesekal is an economist based in Addis Ababa. He was speaking with VOA's Asmama Ayenu. The Southern African Kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, is the only country left in Africa that maintains diplomatic relations with Taiwan, a position strongly opposed by China, which considers Taiwan a renegade province. Eswatini is also a growing trade partner with China, which means the country has to be careful as it reaches out to other nations in Asia for new economic opportunities. Despite threats from Beijing, analysts believe Eswatini can maintain the balancing act. Nakukanya Musi has more from Eswatini's capital, Manzini.
Eswatini's recent efforts to build stronger ties with South Korea, Singapore, and Bhutan could be interpreted as a move away from China, its biggest trading partner in Asia. The tiny kingdom imported more than $109 million in goods from China in 2022, but government spokesperson Alpheus Nxumalo says such a conclusion is presumptive. He argues that diplomacy is a fluid process driven by a country's interests and that Eswatini's current focus on developing relations with other Asian nations reflects a strategic assessment of what is best for the kingdom.
Establishing diplomatic relations with many countries, geopolitics is not centered in one position. Geopolitics is controlled and influenced from various corners of the globe. And as a Eswatini, as a kingdom of Eswatini, that's where we want to make our presence available, and that's where we want to make our presence felt. Where there's geopolitics activities, whether economical trade or diplomacy or even political processes, would want to be engaged. So Eswatini is therefore, according to our cardinal foreign policy, an enemy to none, but a friend to all.
Being friends to all has allowed the tiny Southern African kingdom to maintain diplomatic relations with both China and Taiwan, despite efforts by Beijing to convince Eswatini to cut ties with the self-governing island. China has threatened various measures against Eswatini, but has never carried them out. In a country where nearly 60% of the population lives in poverty, Eswatini's economy was hurt by the COVID-19 pandemic, which was followed by a wave of protests that ruined or damaged many businesses. Mavela Sigwane, head of transformation at the Federation of Eswatini Business Community, says the outreach efforts to South Korea, Singapore, and Bhutan represent more than diplomacy. They hold the potential for significant economic benefits.
This Korea agreement, which has been signed, we're so excited about it. It will open a number of avenues for the local businesses to also tap into the available opportunities in Korea.
By the Korea Agreement, Sigwane is referring to a recent South Korean commitment to spend more than $20 billion in development assistance and investment initiatives in Africa. Eswatini's King Umswati commended South Korea for the commitments and extended an invitation to South Korea businesses to invest in Eswatini. Political analyst Sibusiso Nhlabathi asserts that Eswatini's recent decision to forge economic ties with non-traditional Asian partners illustrates that Eswatini is open to exploring new alliances beyond its historical Western partnerships.
Eswatini seeks to benefit by positioning itself to be more versatile and multi-aligned in actor in that region of Asia. Of course, on the there are geographical implications to this, because Swaziland's balancing act between China and Taiwan, together with its new new partners, they just demonstrate that this can be a tiny country, but it's still independent on foreign policy causes rather than automatically deferring to the interest of larger powers.
Analysts say the expanded trade, increased investment opportunities, and shared technology expected from the new alliances could diversify Eswatini's economy, reducing dependency on any single market. Nokukhanya Musi, VOA News, Menzini, Eswatini.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Simpoga in Washington. Today's Wednesday, July 31st. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Access to abortion is one of the main topics in this year's U.S. presidential race. The Kamala Harris campaign is betting on support for abortion rights, driving voters to the polls in November, while Donald Trump and the Republican Party have toned down their public comments in opposition to abortion. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has more.
U.S. women's reproductive rights are often center stage at Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris's campaign events.
And we, who believe in reproductive freedom, will stop Donald Trump's extreme abortion bans because we trust women to make decisions about their own body and not have their government tell them what to do.
Former President Donald Trump praised the Supreme Court's 2022 overturning of federal protections on abortion access. He stresses he favors each U.S. state deciding on whether to grant or block it.
The Democrats really, and not all of them, because most of them agree with us, they're the radical ones, whereas our position is that abortion is now back to the states.
Trump and the Republican Party have recently toned down their abortion rhetoric, which at times included calls for national abortion bans. That's no accident, says Rutgers University polling expert Ashley Koning. She was interviewed via Skype.
We saw in the midterms and in special elections, when abortion is either directly or indirectly on the ballot, how consequential that has been to elections, and that the voters are coming out on the side in support of reproductive health issues and abortion issues.
Democrats are betting on a pro-choice platform and expressing support for abortion providers. For instance, on July 23rd, Vice President Harris's husband, Doug Emhoff, visited a reproductive health center in McLean, Virginia. The move was praised by the center's medical director, Dr. Jessica Rubino.
I do believe that this is one of the most important topics for the election. It is really important that the vice president, that the second gentleman focus on this, continue to engage with us and work on coming up with a plan.
Among anti-abortion groups, there are those who doubt that reproductive rights will drive a record number of voters to the polls in November. The Trump ticket probably won't sharply increase their focus on abortion, even as the Harris campaign does, in the opinion of National Right to Life Committee President Carol Tobias. She spoke via Skype.
I think they're going to be talking about what they think is important, and I don't know how much they will be responding to her. I think they definitely have to talk about the unborn child being a member of the human family. That deserves protection.
Analysts expect the Trump campaign will continue to prioritize the economy when courting voters, as historically, that has been Americans' top concern in presidential elections. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, McLean, Virginia.
A new study published in the journal Nature suggests that biodiversity loss, which is a decrease in the variety of living organisms, may be a main driver of infectious diseases across the world, followed by non-native species, climate change, and chemical pollution. Professor Jason Rowe, the chair of the Department of Ecology and Public Health at Notre Dame University, is one of the authors of the study. Speaking with VOA's Rick Pantaleo, he explained why those in charge of leading disease control efforts in the past were flying blind, since they did not know which global change drivers most increased or decreased infections.
Well, there's many different global change drivers, five of which we study, the five most prominent in our work. And there could be efforts put toward any of those five. We have limited resources, limited time. And it was never clear before our study was published which of those five global change drivers most increased disease and which most decreased disease. And if there's particular global change drivers that are reducing the risk of infections to humans, you obviously would want to put less time and effort into controlling those drivers of infectious diseases versus those that are increasing disease.
That's interesting. Are there drivers that are reducing the risk?
There are. So we found that habitat loss and change in our study reduced the risk of infectious diseases, particularly for humans. And most of that was driven by the effect of urbanization. And we believe that urbanization is reducing infectious disease for both humans and wildlife because urban environments tend to have less natural area for wildlife hosts and their parasites. And urban settings tend to have greater investments in sanitation and health infrastructure on average relative to rural settings. And so we believe that those are the two likely mechanisms for why urbanization tends to reduce infectious diseases.
You and your collaborators studied both human and non-human animals in your research. Tell me about that.
We did. We were particularly interested in evaluating whether humans were exceptions to any of the generalities that we were able to detect. And we were a little surprised to discover that in most cases they weren't. The patterns were generally consistent for diseases of humans as well as those of wildlife. There were a few exceptions. But the reason why I think that's important is because it suggests that many global change drivers are likely to have impacts on human diseases as well as wildlife, crop, and livestock diseases.
When you're doing the study, did you separate it by regions, continents, countries, and so on?
We did. We had reasonably good coverage across the globe, although there were fewer studies from the global south and global north. And we didn't find any patterns to suggest that there were major differences in the effects of the five global change drivers across the different continents, suggesting that there's generality across host taxa, human and non-human hosts, and across space as well.
So what did the study show regarding climate change and other change drivers impacting the transmission and spread of diseases in Africa?
We didn't actually look at any specific continent. What we did is we tested whether the effects depended on the continent of interest. So we didn't isolate a specific continent. We treated the continents as a separate independent or predictor variable in our analyses and tested whether it interacted with or depended on those continents when we looked at the effects of the global change drivers. We didn't find a statistical interaction which indicated that the results, the impacts of the global change drivers on infectious disease were not dependent on continent, meaning you didn't get significantly different patterns in one continent versus another. The patterns that we did find suggested that biodiversity loss, climate change, introduced species, and chemical pollution all significantly increased disease on average across the studies that we were able to pull from the literature. But we were not able to discriminate the magnitude of the effects between biodiversity loss, climate change, and introduced species. But chemical pollution did have significantly less of an increase in infectious disease relative to biodiversity loss.
That was Professor Jason Rowe, the chair of the Department of Ecology and Public Health at Notre Dame University. He was speaking with VOA's Eric Pantaleo. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week, for joining us tonight. For more African news and features, visit our website at voafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Douglas Simpuk in Washington, wishing you a great day.